Hi, everybody. My name is Frank Sloan, and I am an alcoholic. I have a coat here. I just want to prove that I have one. I'm not going to wear it. I did put on the tie, but well, I watered up a little bit myself during this during that reading, the preamble. In particular, when we say that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, I didn't have that necessarily when I got here. But when I heard that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, it sparked an interest because I didn't have any money. When I came in here, I'd just gotten out of jail again. Well, incidentally, James, were you on that list of people? Did you stand up with everybody who was standing up here?
They didn't call a name.
Well, James has
20 years.
And I am really impressed. It's much more fun for me to sit out. You can tell when I start rubbing my head, I'm nervous. It's messing up my hair. I'd much rather sit out there where you are and hear share 58 years of sobriety. That just knocks my pins out from under me. That is so impressive to me. And, you know, people like you are the people that have kept me coming. And Jim, you know, you keep me coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came into AA, I didn't believe any of that stuff, you know, all this, you know, what's this being sober all these years? That's some sort of con game somebody has going on, you know. Number one, who wants to, right? I just wanted to get the heat off my back. I don't care about this sobriety stuff. I needed my driver's license back, which I knew I was going to lose after I got out of jail, if I had to go to jail, which I didn't have to that time. But I'd been a lot of times, and I'm not going to get involved. You know, we seem to know how to drink. Not successfully, but, you know, and what cracks me up is we talk about practicing alcoholics. I'm practicing my alcoholism, but I never did learn to drink. All those years, you know, I learned how not to drink, that's for sure, and that's why I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, a nice farm guy like me from a farm in Kiowa County, Oklahoma, as Don said, by way of a few other places and ending up in a place like Alcoholics Anonymous with the dregs of society. I decided, you know, I'm going to be in here with a bunch of dumpster divers and all these people that are eating scraps out of the dumpsters, and I didn't want anything to do with you guys. And incidentally, I do want to thank you, Don, for asking me to come up and the committee or whoever. I guess you didn't hear this. So it's going to be a surprise to me, too, what I say. So I'm looking forward to it. I don't know what's going to come out, but we'll see. And James is my agent, I guess. So I appreciate that. He's very highly paid. He shares the take with me, you know, which was wonderful food and fellowship and getting to meet some new friends that I hadn't had a chance to meet yet. And that's one of the things I didn't expect when I came at Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, how blessed we are. You know, what an honor and a privilege and a blessing it is just to be able to come into a room like this on a Saturday. This is a weekend, folks. I mean, I would be about ready to get up from last night when I was getting the weekend started, which I probably started on Thursday, you know. And so it's Saturday. Now I'm going to get up and start really getting ready and tapering off for Monday or Tuesday when I'd probably make it to work. So, you know, it's a pretty good deal just to be able to be here, sober, bright-eyed, keen of mind, what's left of it, you know, and with a bunch of people who are trying to do the same thing through God's grace. And I never expected that. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not going to talk a great deal. Every time I say that, I get into a drunkalogue and never get sober until the last 2 seconds of my, you know, my share. So I didn't want to talk a great deal about getting drunk, but I think, in my opinion anyway, the hook for the new people is the drunkalogue, because you tend not to identify with the steps or anything, because most of you don't know what they are yet. You know, we start talking about the 10th step or the 11th step or something. Well, let me see, what is that one? In fact, I was talking at a big meeting down in Oceanside, California a few years ago. It was a speaker question and answer thing. That's called stump the speaker. That's what those things are. And somebody asked me how I applied the 10th and 11th step in my life. And my mind went blank, totally blank. And I had 25 years sobriety or something at the time, and I couldn't think of the 10th step. It just evaporated. And some newcomer on the front row who had raised her hand said, oh, it's, and told me what it was. So some friends of mine gave me a T-shirt that has the 10th step printed out on it. And I said, you should have printed it upside down so I can just, you know, Superman, and I can read that thing, you know. So anyway, I'm thrilled to be able to be here and sober, because I shouldn't be here. I should probably, if I were alive, I'd be lying in my puke somewhere, if I was lucky, you know, or somebody else's, because that's the way I was with my drinking. And I got to meet Miss Margaret and sit back there and talk with this delightful lady who has the enthusiasm that I've always seen in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still have. And I will tell you this before I get into this thing. I have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe in laughing and having a good time, and I'm a little kooky. And, you know, the oars do not both get in the water at the same time most of the time with me, or, as, you know, my sponsor said, the stairs don't go all the way to the top with you, do they? And I said, well, I don't know what that means, but maybe not. Yeah. And incidentally, somebody mentioned that you don't sound like you're from around here when we were standing out there. And one of my friends down in Diamond Head said, I heard you say y'all the other day. And I want to thank all y'all. Y'all all. But I grew up in Oklahoma, and we said y'all there, you all, usually, instead of y'all. So I know what it means, and it's good. And I love okra, and I love the food. I mentioned to somebody else, too, I've gained 20 pounds since I've lived in the South. I've never eaten such fabulous food in my life. It is just great. Now I've got to do something about that. I guess there's another 12-step program I need to get involved in. So I grew up on a farm in Oklahoma, and hated it, didn't like my mother. I saw my father die when he was 40 years old. He had been he had just turned 40 on August 6th, and on August 16th, 1941, he died. And I was in the room when he died. I saw, I heard, I can still hear his last breath. I remember that death rattle. And that was a traumatic experience for me. I didn't know it at the time, but my mother and my older sisters were crying. All three of them were crying their eyes out, and I cried. But I didn't really know what was going on, and I cried because they were crying, which is the pattern for me. It set up this thing of being a people pleaser and doing whatever it took to make people think I was a part of, and I didn't even know what was going on. You know, I didn't understand it. I mean, now I can see I was a little kid. You know, what does a little kid know about death? And so my dad died, and my mother never remarried, and we lived on a farm, and we were poor, and it was just one of those things. It's no big deal, but I guess I blamed her for that. You know, this woman had a sixth-grade education, or eighth, and I can't remember where she went through school, but whatever it wasn't good enough for me. You see, I judged her, and she should have done better. She should have given me things. She should have had an education. We should have homesteaded Beverly Hills instead of that dirt farm in Oklahoma, as far as I was concerned. And I always wanted more, whatever it was. You know, it was never enough. There was not enough love. In fact, I don't remember. The love was there, but it was never demonstrated. And I didn't know about love until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew about one kind, but that, I guess you call that lust. And I didn't know about anything else. I thought it was love. I mean, I fell in love in a hot minute most of the time. And then when people sobered up and saw what they had, that took care of that in a hurry. So anyway, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered what that four-letter word is called love, and you've given me that, and that's one of the greatest blessings I've ever had. Now, God never deserted me. God was loving me the whole time. I just didn't know it because I'd pushed God out of sight and out of mind as much as I possibly could. I left that farm. I will tell you this, I excelled in athletics when I was a kid growing up. I was scouted as a baseball player in the state of Oklahoma, but I went to Oklahoma State University, which was Oklahoma A&M at the time, and walked onto the basketball court and made the basketball team, the freshman basketball team. I don't know how that happened. There was a coach there named Henry Iba. Some of you heard of Hank Iba. He coached the Olympics. And I made the freshman basketball team, and I quit. after a few weeks because I knew they were going to find out I wasn't good enough to make the freshman basketball team. And if that makes sense to you, then you're probably in the right place because I was a quitter. Before they find out, I will quit. That way I will not fail, you see. So I quit. And I ended up finally the second year because I was a BSer. A big fraternity on campus asked me to be the token poor boy, I guess, and I went over and pledged this fraternity and ended up starting to learn to drink. As I said, I practiced for a lot of years and never did learn successfully, but I tried real hard. And one of the things that happened was I got kicked out of college because I didn't know going to class was part of that deal. I just didn't go. And I got kicked out of college, and then I went to the East Coast to Washington, D.C., and lasted a year and quit a good job in Washington, D.C. to go to Mardi Gras, see where my priorities were. And I came across country with two gals and a friend of mine and a little miniature Doberman pincher, miniature pincher, I guess it's called, in a Henry J. Kaiser. Remember those little cars, a Henry J., no heater in it. We found that you could put vinegar on the windshield, and it would keep the fog from developing. We, you know, were like a bunch of pickles by the time we got to New Orleans. It smelled like it anyway. But, you know, that was important to me, to go to Mardi Gras. In those days, the parade still went through the quarter. That was in 1957, I guess. And I left my friends. I decided, well, you guys go on back. I'm going to go see the coast. And I hitchhiked to... well, I got as far as Mobile, but I found out you can't get through that tunnel walking. So I fiddled around there for a while and ended up, I had enough money to take a bus to Miami Beach. I'm going to be a big shot in Miami Beach and make my fortune down there, and I ended up in the flop house in downtown Miami Beach. And I don't remember really what happened while I was there because I was drunk all the time and got back to Washington, D.C. on a bus somehow. I don't even want to know how I got the money. I don't have the slightest idea. And stayed there for a few days and went back to Oklahoma and lasted 4 months while I was in Oklahoma. And went to work for a drug company, which was fun. And then went to California to sweep the gold off the streets there because I needed to be discovered. I mean, it wasn't an actor or anything, but I knew they'd... I mean, if they can find Lana Turner in a drugstore, they ought to be able to find me in a bowling alley, for crying out loud, you know. So I went to Huntington Park, California, or someplace, yeah, and got a job with another drug company with all my 4 months of credentials with this drug company, and I worked for Abbott Laboratories, and they made a little drug called Dazoxin, which is dextrin, and I'm just in the drug log, this is the only time I'll mention it because the only time I took them, we would take Dazoxin so we could stay awake and drink. That's what I thought they were for. All I remember about that, we would steal them out of the warehouse. They didn't have the controls that they have today on drugs. And so we stole the Dazoxin, and we would take 15 milligrams a few times during the day if we were going out that night. And I remember that we didn't get any work done, and we drank a lot of water and smoked a lot of cigarettes, talked a lot, and got nothing done, but we were quick about it, you know. That's my experience with drugs, you know. I like the liquid form, you know. And I remember the one night, my first time in jail in California, I'd gone to a bowling alley, and I had my first martini. Wow. I mean, Oklahoma was a dry state. And we used to have to drive to Kansas to get our booze, but they had 3.2 beer, and I'll tell you, I don't know how many know this, but you can get drunk on 3.2 beer. You just go to the restroom a lot more often, I guess. So, anyway, I had martinis, and I thought it was so cute. The bartender said, well, do you want it dry? I didn't know what dry meant, you know. I said, oh, yeah, very dry. Sounded good to me. So he would shine a light through the vermouth bottle, a flashlight, and he said, is that dry enough? I said, oh, yeah, I thought that's what it was about. I didn't know. He said, yeah, that's great. Well, I had a few of those one night, and I ended up fighting in downtown Los Angeles. I was down there, and I was fighting with three guys, and I helped the cops catch one of them, and I was beating him. I had his arm under my arm, you know, head under my arm, and I was beating him in the face, and the cops thanked me and took us all to jail after I'd been so helpful. And I was 22, And it's my first time in jail now. I know there's some people here who have been in jail a lot younger than that, but that was my first time, and I did not like it. The downtown drunk tank in downtown Los Angeles, there were 40 or 50 other people in there, and I draw myself up in the corner better than any of them, you know, because I'm wearing a nice pair of slacks and a nice sweater, you know, and ooh, these drunks in here. And then the next morning they took everybody out of that cell but me. I was the only one left. I didn't know what was happening. That really scared me, because what had happened, I was the only one that had enough money for bail, and they just hadn't gotten around to me. They took the rest of them over to Lincoln Heights or somewhere for booking and all this sort of thing, and they let me out. And that was my first experience of many times in jails in California. And it just progressed and progressed and progressed. I left the drug company because someone said what you need to be is in sales. Well, I went into sales, and the worst part about that was that I'm good at talking, but if you say no, then my feelings get hurt. You know, and I can't stand rejection. And boy, somebody that can't stand rejection should not be in sales. All I was selling was shredded wheat and milk bone, you know, to the grocery stores. But I went and had a job with Nabisco, and I lasted in that job a year and a half, and I quit before they could find out that I'd been falsifying my sales reports all that time. You know, if somebody said, well, I don't want any, I'd say, well, that's 10 cases right there. Yeah. And it made sense to me. But the thing is, I would go call on my accounts, and I'd pump myself up, I'd psych myself up, read all those self-help books, Think and Grow Rich and all these things, and every alcoholic's read those books, I swear. And I would go in, I'd say, okay, today I'm going to go to Alpha Beta, and I'm going to do this, and then he'll say this, and I'll say this, and then that SOB will probably say that, and I'm not going to go in there and be insulted like that. And I hadn't gotten out of the car yet, you know. And I would do that all day, because I didn't have the courage to go in and call on these accounts. So I wouldn't call on them. And then about 4 o'clock, I'd have to go to my favorite watering hole where my best friends, Bill and Reggie, were the bartenders. And I'm talking about those sorry SOBs out there who weren't buying my merchandise, blah, blah. And I hadn't been to see any of them yet. And I'd stay there and close the bar. And then I couldn't go home because I'd been not calling on customers all day, and I'd been drinking, and I was drunk again. So I would go up to the end of my driveway. I had a great house down on the water, and I would sleep in the car, because you can't go home, because they will know what you've been up to. And I was living by myself now, see, that's how sick you are. But somebody might know, whoever that was, you know, they were there. Remember that little shadow? Or whoever, and they were going to find out. And then the next day, okay, today I'm going to go call on the markets. And I do it again. And I did it time after time after time. And then I quit, because the problem was I didn't have my college degree. So I went back to college. Got a job in a service station pumping gas and changing tires and all that sort of thing. And went to college and got a degree. I was going to be an English teacher, and then decided, well, I'll get into educational radio and television, because that's really lucrative. And so I thought that I would do that, but I'm scared of people. So I go to Disneyland and get a job at Disneyland, and there's, you know, 100,000 a day coming through there. And I kept that job for 4 years. That was a great job. I loved working at Disneyland. Good-looking young people out there, and we had the best parties you ever saw. And we had names for you people, and I'm not going to tell you what they were. But there were certain names that we called the guests at Disneyland. LBK means little bitty kid. And all that. We had initials for everything. And I got fired from Disneyland as a result of my drinking. And I'll tell you that, and then I'll get into sobriety. Because James mentioned it, I'd forgotten it. When I worked at Disneyland, as I said, I was there for 4 years, and I had to go to Howard Johnson's watering hole across the street to get up the courage to face children at Disneyland. I was in management, if you can call, you know, telling somebody, okay, this is what you, how you point out the hippopotamus on the jungle cruise, you know. So, but I was in management, and we had the Disneyland Recreation Club for employees' children. When the park was closed during the winter, we had the employees' kids come into the Fantasyland Theater, and we showed them Disney movies and cartoons Monday and Tuesday nights when the park was closed. And it was a great deal for the, for those kids. But I couldn't face them. I mean, those little beady-eyed monsters were going to be out there judging me, and I couldn't stand that. Now, remember, I'd gone to a little country school. There were 11 in my graduating class from high school. There was no junior class at all because they had both moved the year before. And there were 24 in the whole high school. That's 9th through 12th grade. And, you know, I was the senior class president because it was my turn. Everybody else had already been there, you know. And I said, well, let Frank do it after all. So, and I couldn't give the senior speech because I was scared to death. And these are people I had known since first grade. I couldn't do it. So at Disneyland, here I have to get in front of a bunch of children, sort of like you, except there were more of them, and introduce a movie. And I was drunk one night, and I overshot the mark, and I said something, I introduced Fantasia, and I said something about the, I won't say the word, but the effing hippos. And then I said it again. I said something about their effing tutus or something. And that does not go over well in the Magic Kingdom, I can tell you that. So, they took my pixie dust away from me, you know. And I lost my job, and they sent me out into the cold, cruel world, and I had to go get a real job. And I went with Blue Cross of Southern California, and if your claims have been screwed up, it's probably because of me, because I was in charge of training. I didn't know an appendectomy from a hysterectomy, I can tell you that. And here I'm teaching people how to be claims examiners. At Blue Cross of Southern California, we would have 50,000 claims in the pipeline. That's a day, you know, waiting to be processed. And I was in charge of training. You know, I didn't know anything because I was drinking myself into oblivion most of the time. And I got fired from that job after 13 months because they said I was inadequate. Can you imagine saying something that, like that to a big shot like me? Because I would sit in my office and plan how I was going to take over Blue Cross. Because my office was across the balcony from the president's office, which was way, there was a pit down here where all the workers were. And the president's office was over there, and I was transferring myself into his shoes, see, and how much money I was going to make, how I was going to spend it. I would map it out and put it all down here, daydream, never into day. And they fired my little butt and sent me out in the cold, cruel world again. And then I went to work for Carnation Company, lied my way into it, into the job, told them I was a training specialist. I didn't know anything. So they hired me, those poor fools. And the first assignment that I had with Carnation Company, we owned Contadina Foods and Frisky's Pet Foods and so all those things. And we had this breeding farm up in Wisconsin. And they sent me to Watertown, Wisconsin, the Piper Brothers breeding farm. And my first job was to make a movie. A movie. Of semen collection. Wasn't it wonderful to have a college degree and I get to go take pictures of this bull? I had some great close-ups, I can tell you. Do you know what a charlet is? It's a big white one. It's huge. And I'm underneath that thing with this, you know, film because they have this artificial vagina. How did I get into this tonight? That's heated and all that sort of thing. Anyway, I did all that sort of stuff. And then my movie was X-rated. And they wouldn't show it in the state of Wisconsin where it was filmed or in the country of Peru. Because we had farms and things down there, too. So that was my first experience at porno. I'd forgotten all about that, you know. And then they decided they better promote me out of that job, and they put me in as a production management trainee. So I go to all these plants where we make Coffee Mate or whatever it is, and I'm teaching people how to be managers out there. And, you know, all this stuff was whizzing by you on these. I don't know anything. And I got through that for 3 years. Well, my drinking was progressing. I was getting thrown in jail more, but I had a company credit card, and I traveled the United States and Canada on the company drinking, going to bars, lying about who I am and what a big shot I am with all these other people that are out there lying about what... I think I recognized James from one time in there, one of those bars in an airport. And that was my life. I loved that job because it sounded good, but I knew they were going to find out I didn't know what I was doing, and they were beginning to get an inclination, I think. But I ended up, finally, they promoted me again out of that job. That's what happens in government, too, I think, you know. So I ended up in charge of college recruiting. And so I traveled to all the United States campuses and graduate schools, and I've been at the University of Alabama, and I've been at Tuskegee, and I've been at all these places interviewing graduating students to go to work for our company and as management trainees. And then they put me in charge of executive management development. I mean, I'm a farmer. I never managed anything except 4-H, you know, and that was about it. And I'm doing these things and not knowing what I'm doing and getting by with it. And then I get arrested again, and I end up in the jail in Davis, California. Not in Davis, in Woodland. I was arrested by the campus police in Davis because I was going up the off-ramp of the freeway. I was going to be a wrong-way driver, and I'd gotten really drunk. And the way that happened, I had ended up checking into a motel that didn't have a bar, and they sent me to a good restaurant that had a bar, which was really important for me. And I ended up there having a split of wine because I'd seen it on TV, and it looked elegant and classy to me. Alcoholics don't know what a split of wine is because there's not enough to gargle with. You know, it's this much. And then the next thing I remember, I was talking with a sheep herder in the bar, not out in the flock, and don't go there. Then the police were pulling me out of my car again, and I go to jail again, and I knew that was the end of my career. Because I had so many jail sentences, I was going to lose a driver's license this time and go to jail for several days. And I got out on an OR, and then I had a date coming back, and I went home. And for the first time in my life, I asked this God that I had pushed out of my life years ago to help me by making the plane crash and killing me. That's the only kind of help I knew to ask for. Please kill me. Get me out of this pain. I can't stand it anymore. And you know, for a long time I didn't know I was in pain because I was always covering up with booze. You see, I was scared all the time. I felt inadequate all my life. I felt inferior all my life. And if I drank enough, I could stand up straight and talk to anybody. I mean, I dealt with the president, the CEO of our company all the time. All the time. And I've always been afraid of any sort of authority. I mean, the postman. Anybody with a uniform, it scares me, whoever they are. A service station, whatever it is, you got on a uniform, I get tense. Now, even today, I go through customs coming from Canada or something, and I feel guilty. Haven't done a thing. Haven't bought anything. I'm so careful. Don't buy. And they say, where are you from? And I can't even get it out. Are you a U.S. citizen? I don't even know. Yeah. But I ended up asking God to make the plane crash, and the plane didn't crash, but I can tell you a different guy got off the other end of the plane, you know, the other end of that flight, because I was not the same person because I'd asked for help. Nothing happened on the flight other than the fact that I had said, please kill me, which was my cry. And the next day, I went to work and shared with my drinking buddy what had happened, and he suggested I call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did, because I didn't know what else to do. And I thought, boy, you've hit rock bottom. But they'll tell me what to say to the judge, and I'll give it a... I won't tell them anything, you know, and all that sort of thing. So I went home that day, and I called Central Office in Orange County, California, and they asked me where I live, and I said, it's none of your business. Why do you need to know that? See, I knew what you had in mind for me. You were going to send an old converted gray school bus that had big red AA all over the side of it to my house in my nice neighborhood, and you were going to embarrass me in front of my neighbors, and I was going to get a tambourine and a religious tract and have to go out and save souls in downtown Santa Ana. Now, all I knew about downtown Santa Ana was that when you come out of a blackout naked on the streets, it's not pleasant. I've done that. I was talking with somebody, thank God for blackouts, because a lot of stuff I don't remember. What I remember is bad enough. But, I'm an upstanding citizen. I'm naked. You know, got a wristwatch on, that's it, baby. So, anyway, I said, I told Central Office, ask them, why do you need to know where I live? And they said, so we can tell you what meetings to go to that's near your home. And I thought, what is this meeting stuff? I don't understand that. So they said, gave me the telephone number, the Atlanta Club in Anaheim, California, said, you call that number. And I called, and another Okie picked up the phone. Now, down here, this doesn't go over. In California, it sounded good, because he said, can I help you? And that's normal talk here, you know. In California, when he said, can I help you, I said, oh, he's an Okie. And I said, I don't know whether you can help me or not. And he said, well, do you have a drinking problem? I said, I might. And he said, well, can you drive a car? I said, yes, I can drive a car. He said, well, do you have one? I said, yes. The boy, this guy is really a dip. And a wino. I knew what he was. And he said, well, my name's Dean Flower. You come on down here. And I said, okay. Clenched teeth, because he had just challenged me, and I was going to show him what he had on the telephone. He knew, but I didn't know. So I wore a suit and carried a briefcase. So that's the way I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he would be impressed. And anybody that saw me knows, you know, you can tell I'm an attorney anyway. Now, but, you know, right, Jane? So I parked my car in front of the club so they could see it and be impressed. If you didn't look at the back fenders, you'd be impressed. The front of the car looked good. Anybody else get had whiskey dents all over the back of their car? Man, those things are awful, aren't they? And so I parked and had my blue suit, three-piece vest, my real leather brief. Real leather, none of that phony stuff for me, baby, because you know I'm a big shot. Couldn't pay the house payment, but I'm got a leather briefcase. And I walked up the steps of this place with Dean's name written on a piece of paper, as any attorney would. I walked in and says, my name, there was nobody in there except a pilot, a captain in the Air Force, wearing his blues. And I thought, oh, well, he's waiting for some wino. And I said, my name is Frank Sloan, and I've come to see Dean Flowers. And he looked at me and he says, I'm Dean. How could that be? This guy's a captain in the Air Force. And I'm standing there trying to act like an attorney, which I'm not. But I had my attorney look on. I mean, I was dressed for it. Look how he's dressed. Look at that. So I came in here trying to act like an attorney. I've been an attorney many times. Many, many times, right? Are there any other astronauts in this room? That's right. Any other freedom fighters? Brain surgeons? See, I've been all those things. I am so talented. I'm never told anybody I was a milkman. Never met another milkman in the bars. Only brain surgeons and astronauts and movie stars. Faded movie stars that I couldn't recognize, you know. So anyway, that's the way I was. And here I'm in this place trying to act like an attorney. I'm not. He can see right through me, and I know it. And he calls the manager of the club down, who is a mean, ugly-looking guy. Oh, he was mean. He scared me. He was an ex-convict. An ex-convict, I drew my little hand up. Ooh. Those guys took me in the little shake-and-bake room in the corner, which were the extent of the recovery hospitals in those days, right, Jim? And that's where they started telling me about Alcoholics Anonymous. One drunk talking to another. In this case, two drunks talking to another. And they started trying to out-bottom each other, you know, to impress me. They would tell all these stories and, you know, ooh. This convict in particular, you know, telling me this stuff. And then they would laugh and they started talking about God, and you could hear my mind slam shut clear across the street when they started talking about God, because I knew I'd found a bunch of Bible thumpers, and I wouldn't have anything to do with that, because I'd been saved twice a week for years when I was growing up, you know. Wednesday prayer meeting and Sunday at church. I get saved when they ask, you know, I had the altar call, and I would always go. We had a different kind of denomination in the country every week, or every 3 weeks, I guess it was. But I got saved all the time because I would sin, you know. I'd go behind the barn and do things that my mother said was going to make me go blind, you know. Or make me feeble-minded or something, you know. And so then I'd have to go get saved because of that. And then, and I meant it. I always meant it. All my intentions were good. And then I would go home from church, and that barn was attractive. I mean, my first affair was marvelous. It's just too bad I was by myself, you know. But that's the way it was, and it was a sin, and so on and so forth. So I went through all that stuff, and they started talking about God, and I said, "Oh, please, I'm doomed. I'm doomed." Anyway, so they said, "Well, you come back to a meeting tonight," and I said, "Okay." That's when they're going to tell me what to say to the judge. That's what I figured. And so I went to a meeting tonight, and a woman. It was a speaker meeting, and a woman talked. She was a tiny little lady, about like Miss Margaret, and she got up and she started talking. I turned her off because I knew she had nothing of interest to say to me. And she probably drank a little kitchen sherry and a thimble or something. Big deal. You know, what do I? And you know, I'm not an alcoholic anyway. I need to know what to say to the judge. Well, I didn't hear her, but later I heard that woman talk. Now, she had a story. I'm glad I didn't hear her. I probably wouldn't be in AA today. She would have scared me out of here because she used to pistol whip people. I mean, she'd get drunk and do a hold up and beat the tar out of them with her pistol. She was this big. Did you ever do that, Miss Margaret? So, anyway, after that meeting, they took me over to some coffee shop and made me drink coffee for 6 months that night. That was the longest night I've ever had in my life because I'm waiting for them to tell me what to say to the judge, and they still don't tell me. But they would just, they were so, how many people have less than a year in here? Would you raise your hands again? Have we taken you out to a coffee shop yet for a hot fudge sundae and embarrassed the pants off you? Because we're real loud. And we don't care about people knowing that we're alcoholics, and, you know, we are sensitive, right? When we're new, even when we're old, we're sensitive. And they would embarrass me, and they would talk about being drunk. Say, "Hey, I'm an alcoholic, ha, 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 and I got arrested, and oh, God, I'm trying to hide under the booth," you know, and all this sort of thing. What if somebody hears this, you know, and who am I hanging out with? After all, I'm an attorney, you know. It's hard to act like one in a coffee shop with a bunch of drunks around you, you know. And so I started doing this sort of thing. And then Dean gave me the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd gone on a business trip, and he said, "Don't drink," but I drank after 6 days on that trip. I had 4 drinks, 2 in the Lansing, Michigan airport, and 2 on the plane going back to Los Angeles. And I got back, and he asked if I drank, and I said, "Of course not, because 4 drinks is not drinking, right?" And you said the first drink is what gets you drunk, and the first drink hadn't gotten me drunk. I had 4 and didn't get drunk. 2,000 miles, you know, and all that stuff. And so I lied because I wanted to help him, you know, because his program was important to him and he needed it. And I'm obviously not an alcoholic. But then he gave me the book and he said, "Now you take this book," and he wrote inside it, "between the covers of this book, you find the answers to any problems you'll ever have. Love, Dean." And I said, "I cannot take that book, Dean." He said, "Why?" I said, "Look at the dust jacket on that thing. It's got these big white neon letters flashing on and off that say Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't take that book." He said, "Didn't you tell me you had these college degrees?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, did you know you can turn that dust jacket all around backwards?" I said, "Oh." So he said, "Now you read the first 164 pages of this book." So I get on the plane to go meet the judge, and I get in, and I have the cover turned over so you can't see it, you know, what it says. And I get in the plane, and I'm reading. He said, "You read it from cover to cover, but you just worry about the first 164 pages. But he said, it's a textbook, and you start at the cover, and you read the introduction and all this stuff. So I did that, you know, sort of skimmed it. I'm trying to find the part in the book that says the judge will say this, and your response is to be this. Well, I do great until I get to chapter 1, page 2. Page 2, I turn the page over. At the top of the page, it says Alcoholics Anonymous in these big, bold letters. And since everybody on the plane is extremely interested in me and what I'm reading, I'm trying to cover it up, you know, and read this thing and then get this, find what the judge says. And I couldn't find it in that book. And I'm going from Orange County to Sacramento to rent a car and go back and meet the judge, and I couldn't find it. And I'm scared to death, so I call Alcoholics Anonymous again. I thought, well, this is a university town. Maybe there's somebody smart enough up here, if one of them happens to be an alcoholic, to tell me what to say to the judge. So I called, and this little old gal got on the phone, and she said, you sit there, honey, and I'll have somebody come see you. And this guy came over and did what we do. One drunk talking to another drunk. He happened to be the dean of the School of Veterinary Medicine at Davis. And my car had been left on the grounds of the School of Veterinary Medicine when the campus police arrested me. And I said, oh, I was at your place a few weeks ago. He had 4 years sobriety, and our stories were almost similar. He was exactly the person I needed at the time that I was willing to listen. He talked me through my fears, which is what we do. Didn't cure anything, didn't tell me what to say to the judge, nothing, but I guess I was able to breathe a little easier because here was somebody that understood. The first time in my life I'd found somebody that seemed to understand. And I faced the judge the next day, lost my driver's license, all that stuff, and then started going to Alcoholics Anonymous because Dean, his little sports car, he was the kind that had sports cars, and his sports car wasn't working. But his driver's license was. My driver's license wasn't working. My car was. So he took my car. And then he felt obligated to call me every day and take me to a meeting. And I felt obligated to go to check on my car. Because he believed in pulling drunks out from under park benches. And they did dirties in my car once in a while. Because you know how drunks are coming out from under park benches when they don't want to get saved, you know. And we will hold them out and take them to recovery homes. Come with us. We will save you. I didn't even know what I was doing. Dean had 1 year. He was an AA Nazi at that time. He didn't know either. And I had, you know, 3 weeks. Sure, you know, I'm quick about everything, you know, I'm crazy. And for the first year, that's all I did. I don't remember much about it, except I did a lot of that stuff. Just went, because they told me to go. And I didn't have a driver's license, so I might as well, you know. And then at the end of the first year, I started talking about my birthday. Dean started talking about my birthday. Oh, you're going to get a cake. Everybody's going to sing to you. We're going to have fun. And I had had those 4 drinks, and I hadn't told him about the change of dates. He had the wrong date. I couldn't handle it because you talked about rigorous honesty somewhere in that first year. And for some reason, for the first time in my life, something had an impact on me. I'd never been honest about anything. But I took a deep breath one day, and I said, Dean, my birthday's not on the 15th. It's on the 21st of January. He said, then we'll change the date. That's all he said. And I'd almost gotten drunk about that. I worried about it for a year. And he said, then we'll change the date. How simple. I never thought about anything like that with all my 30s, you know. You know, he was interested in me being honest. That's what he was interested in. First time, a little bit of honesty, just a little bit, as much as I could handle at that time. So I was a little bit honest. Then I told my boss I was going to AA, and he didn't fire me the way I expected. And then I went back and made amends to a young lady who was a nationally known ice skater, competitive figure skater, and she was like a daughter to me. And I'd taken her out for her 18th birthday, and I tried to rape her. I got drunk. And I went back to make amends to her before I'd ever done any of the other steps, but I had to do that. And I went back, and she was back east skating, and I told her I was sorry for what I'd done, and she said, what did you do? And it was all in my mind. I said, you know, I tried to rape you. She said, no, you didn't. I said, why did you go home that night? Her family was going to be at my house the next day. She was going to spend the night with me. She said, because you were a slob. I couldn't stand to be around you. So thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. That, you know, that I would never have known that I hadn't tried to do that and carried that one around with me. It's one of the worst things I can think that anybody could ever do to somebody else. And I was able to stand up a little straighter, just a little bit, and look myself in the eye a little bit. And then I met my real sponsor, first sponsor. This is a man who had spent 22 years in prison, ex-convict. He'd been in six times. This is the man that taught me that four-letter word, love. This is the man that worked the steps with me. This is the man that welcomed me into his family. He became my dad. He became my brother, my mentor, my best friend, everything. He was wonderful. He was a gentle man, a gentleman. He was a beautiful guy. And he was my sponsor. He died 16 years ago. And then I sponsored myself for 6 years, and that's a mistake. We mentioned that earlier. Anything was a good idea, I'd say, Frank, why don't you do that? I said, that's a good idea, Frank, do it, you know. So, I mean, I was on a dry drunk for a period of time, and then I got another sponsor who's from West Texas. He talked slower than anybody I've ever heard in my life. And I'd call him up, and I'd say, I'm going crazy. He said, well, what's wrong, Frank? I forgot by then. You know, my world-pressing problem by the time he said, what's wrong, I don't even know, you know. Another man, just the person I needed, a brilliant man, degree in psychology and all that sort of stuff, is just what I needed. But the friends that I have met in Alcoholics Anonymous, the people I get to hang out with, the people I get to be with on a daily basis, it has kept me clean and sober and crazy sometimes, but relatively sane. My best friend, a Jew from the Bronx of New York, a well-known jazz musician, has won Grammys and Emmys. He's one of my best friends. How does that happen? A Southern Baptist from a farm in Oklahoma and a Jew from the Bronx in New York. Another one, a mechanic. He's got what we call the keep coming back garage. He's from Huntington, West Virginia. I'm his sponsor. He's fabulous. We have so much fun with that guy. He calls me today and says, I'm about to drink if you don't call me right away. So I call about 3 days later. I said, well, did you drink? He said, no, I was waiting for you to call. And another one's a guy who's another ex-con, black fellow from San Francisco. He said he was a huge, he's about 6 inches taller than me. He said he got sober. He was in the Haight-Ashbury district during the hippie days. And he says, I had this big old afro, he said, with living things in there, you know. He said he hadn't had a bath for a long time. He was a kid, you know, out doing his thing. He was so funny when he got out of prison. He's got 22 years now. So where he got out of prison, he came down and he said, nobody will hire me. Nobody wants me. I'm an ex-con, blah, blah, blah. And we just gave him such a bad time. Finally, we saw it have the paper. And Jim, the garage guy, said, now, Mike, I want you to go over to the city of Glendale because the city of Glendale is looking for a black alcoholic ex-convict. He went over and he got the job. And he's still there. And he's a director or manager or something of a power plant or something. He's great. Now, these are my friends. I would never have had the opportunity to meet him if it hadn't been for Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't have had an opportunity to meet God if it hadn't been for you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, to really get to know God as well as I can. You know, God had never given up on me this whole time, and I thought he had. I told Wes, my sponsor, I said, Wes, I don't believe in God. He said, act as if you believe in God, Frank. I said, I can't do that. That's phony. He said, then you won't have any trouble, Frank. He was so nice, you know, I didn't know I'd been insulted for 2 days. You know, that's just the way he was with me. So I acted as if I believed in God, and I gave you lip service for 8 years. The first 8 years I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I acted as if I believed in God, and I didn't. I didn't. Well, maybe a little, just in case. You know, I always, I'm the kind, I wanted to get saved 10 minutes before I died, so I wouldn't miss any of the fun, I thought. Well, I was 8 years sober, and I was reading the book, and I said, well, I'll be damned. It tells me right in the book where God is. I didn't know that. I was looking in all the wrong places. And it says right in the book where God is. It says it's deep within. Deep within. You told me that. You gave me that knowledge. Now, I'm not going to tell you where it is or what page it's on. But for the newcomers, see, that's what we do when we're old-timers. We tell you, you go find it. It's in the book. Since I can't remember what page it is anyway. And said, then I want you to come back and tell me where it is.
Hey, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, yeah.
It's great. Now, you, but 2 weeks, I want you to go find that in the book and come back and tell us. Anyway, I got involved in this program of living we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had 30 years of wonderful times and bad times and wonderful times and bad times. But the bad times haven't been that bad because I know that I'm going to get to the other side. And when I was drinking, I never knew I would get to the other side. Because this had happened, it was going to be that way forever. And I knew it. And you said, it's not going to be that way forever, Frank. It will change. As you change, it will change. So I had to do that. You know, that's all I've had to do. You know, I just had to get honest for the first time in my life. I had to share that with somebody else. I had to make amends. Had to try to work with other alcoholics, you know, and pray to God. Now, how simple can it be? That's all I've had to do. Hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But that's the simplest thing I've ever done in my life for what I've gotten from it, and that is a feeling of belonging to the human race for the first time in my life. Being able to, well, I live in Mississippi, for God's sakes. I don't even know why. I don't. My friends in California said, you went on vacation and you bought a house in Mississippi. I said, I know. They said, why? I said, I don't know. I'm impulsive, I guess. But I'm here for a reason. And maybe part of it is to find out that I can change. I can accept change today, and I was never able to do that before. I learned to love my mother in Alcoholics Anonymous. She came to spend a couple of weeks with me, and she stayed 14 years. She was fabulous. God, she was amazing how she changed when I got sober. She just turned into a fabulous woman. She was lovely and loving and caring and fun. And a great mother, and I'm glad I got to know her, and you gave me that. We had a blast, and she got Alzheimer's, and we went through a lot of stuff, and you got me through that, because I was saying, she's doing it to me. You know, that's where my head went. Why me? Why me? And my friend Sue said, why not you, Frank? You know, I learned. You said, Frank, let us worry about it for you. And I did, after 4 years of fighting it. I let you worry about it. And I was able to keep Mom at home and didn't have to institutionalize her. And it was tough. It was a tough, tough thing. But I loved her, and you gave me the ability, and financially I was able to do it. I'll tell you this right now, and I'm not bragging, but I am financially fixed for life if I die by noon Tuesday. That's what happens around here. Don't worry about it, you know. Whatever, you know, I've got today, right? So my life has been a series of surrenders, and you've given me that. I've known some fabulous people. You know, Dr. Paul was a friend of mine. Paul died last year, and we quote him all the time in the book, Dr. Alcoholic Addict. And the last time I shared in Laguna Beach, Paul was down there. He was the guy in charge, and he had more sobriety than me. He was the guy in charge of sending out the tapes to the speaker. He was active. He was involved. Chuck Chamberlain was an active guy. He used to go to my friend Sue's and sit on the floor. He and his wife Elsa would sit on the floor because I cooked. And we'd been taking meetings to my friend Sue, who's been in a hospital bed for over 25 years. And we started taking meetings to her 25 years ago, and we still take them. they still take them. I'm not there. And it's a fabulous time. We have so much fun. I'll tell you the thing about Sue. She, when I was new, she scared me. She was from Alabama, incidentally. She's from Huntsville. She was a hillbilly out there somewhere, she said, and they used to chase each other around the house with shotguns when they were drunk. Uncle Fate. And get on his horse and shoot at him, you know. And Sue had 8 years sobriety when I was new, and she was a redhead and gorgeous, and she would talk about all these things. And I thought, ooh, she is mean. That is the meanest woman I've ever seen in my life. She was a nurse. She used to get out and try to hitchhike in the rain with her surgical mask on. Nobody would pick her up. She was drunk, you know. She says, I'm trying to help the sick, and nobody would pick me up, you know. But I was telling Sue about waking up with all these pigs when I was drinking, because I was a bar drinker, and I would go out looking for love. And, you know, nobody's ugly at 2 a.m., as you know. And I said, Sue, I used to wake up with all these pigs. And she says, honey, you men don't have a corner on the pig market, you know. She says, she was a bar drinker. She says, I used to wake up with a lot of them, too. And she looked at me, and she says, come to think of it, Frank, you look familiar. Now, that hurts a sensitive alcoholic. You know, that hurts me a lot when that happens. Okay, it's time to, I think it was, yeah, it's time for me to sit down. I'm going to tell you a story about my neighbor. And some of you may have heard this. That story got around pretty quickly, I know. But my neighbor was a German guy. His name was Alex Heschle. He's dead now. But Alex was from Germany, and he went to Argentina. Mm-hmm. Then came to the United States, and he was fluent in 5 languages, and he taught at a parochial school, a Catholic school in Chatsworth, or in Canoga Park, California. And his neighbor on the other side of him, I was here, and he was between me and this other school teacher, a woman, and Alex had these, what are those big German, Doberman pincers. You know those big dogs? They've got these cold, hard noses that they poke you with. That's interesting. Hurts, too. And the dogs were named Hans and Otto. Nice dogs. Nice, friendly dogs. But the other school teacher had rabbits. She raised show rabbits, Angoras and all those. I don't know anything about rabbits, but I'm glad I was sober when I saw those rabbits, because I would have thought I was seeing pink elephants. Some of them, you know, they had curly tails and long hair, and, you know, they didn't look like rabbits, some of them. But all of them had died except her prize Angora white rabbit or something. And Alex came to school one day, and Hans and Otto were playing tug of war with that rabbit in the backyard, this beautiful white dead rabbit. And he went out and grabbed that rabbit and took it in the house and gave it a shampoo and a blow dry, and went out and put it back in its cage in her backyard. And she came home, and he heard her screaming, and he went out acting innocent and stuck his head over the fence and said, what's wrong? And she says, my rabbit, it's my rabbit. He says, what's wrong? Is it dead? She said, it died a week ago. I buried it. It's back in its cage. Now, the moral of that story, which is just the story, incidentally, Sue told me that, and I bet it just like you did. I believed it. But the moral is, for the newcomers, things are not always as they appear. And the things that look tough today and look insurmountable are not. And your past is your present. And it's the best thing that happened to you, because it's given you strength to be here. And you're going to look back at that, and it's going to keep you here, because you don't have to go back to it. You can stay here and be sober, happy, joyous, and free, and walk on the sunny side of the street. Hang on to us, because we need to hang on to you, because I need to be reminded what it was like. Having new people in my life is a joy. It's an absolute joy, because you keep me sober. You keep me reminded of what it was like. And I don't want to do that again. And I hope that, you know, I'm an example. I don't know whether I am or not, good, bad, or indifferent, but I'm sober. And you can stay sober, too, no matter what. no matter what, you don't have to drink unless you choose to do so. Don't let anybody keep you out of a meeting. You have a chair here. If you get a resentment, let the other person leave instead of you. You keep coming back because you always are welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous. You never have to take another drink as long as you live, a day at a time, unless you choose to do so. We'll go to hell with you. But if you drink, you can go by yourself because you will. You know, we've come out of hell into this living program of love and service. And that's what we have. You get to keep it by giving it away. And you don't know you're giving it away sometimes just by sitting there, but you are. We're creatures of habit. My sponsor made me sit in the same chair every Saturday night. I said, I don't want to sit there. I want to sit in the back and talk about the speakers. He said, you sit there. I said, why? He said, because somebody expects you to be there. Same sit chair in the front. He said, the sick ones sit in the front. I still sit in the front, incidentally. That's where I am. He said, somebody you will never know probably expects you to be in that chair. It gives them assurance that it's working for somebody. And you know it's true. I go to my regular meetings. The people I see are sitting in their regular chairs. I bet at your regular meetings you sit in your regular chair. And if somebody's in your chair, you glare at them. Don't they know that's my seat? You know. But I did that. I learned to do that. What a joy this has been. What a blessing we have. God has given us life. You know, and I thought about being born again all those years. That's what's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been born again. I've been given the ability to stand up tall and be counted, clean house, try to help another alcoholic, and in so doing, such something so simple, I've just helped myself. And you've helped me immensely today. What a joy this has been. Thank you.